Les colloques du Collège de France.
Let's start the last part of the day, which will be maybe sort of a wrap up of the different ideas we've heard about, both on the end of psychiatric epidemiology and also regarding social determinants of health. What we know, where we can have maybe more research, where we're headed. So we'll start with Professor Eric Fonbonne, who is a child and adolescent psychiatrist. He's Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Science University. He trained in France and held appointments as clinical scientist at INSERM in France, then a senior lecturer at the Institute of Psychiatry and Maudsley Hospital at King's College London, and then he was at a tenured professor of psychiatry at McGill University, and head of division in of child psychiatry and Canada research chair in child psychiatry before he moved to Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. So he's done pioneering work in psychiatric epidemiology in France and later turned his activities to the study of developmental disorders in children and adolescents, using clinical, longitudinal, and population-based epidemiological studies, as well as clinical trials and genetic studies. So we'll first hear about psychiatric epidemiology.
Well, thank you very much for your invitation and this introduction. I'll try to be brief. So the answer to this question is, I don't know. I have some ideas on how we could have a future, but that's what I'm going to talk about. I don't know exactly where it goes. So be modest in your expectations. This is my disclosure. You can look at it. I always do it by principle. And then, I just want to start again, but there's been a number of things already said. So I'll try to speed up a bit, not be too redundant. So the field of psychiatric epidemiology really started at the turn of the 19th century with Durkheim. We heard studies about suicide and anomie, and there was a big series of decades where there were sociologists who were very involved in mental health. They were looking at associations, for instance, between the concentration of psychiatric disorders like schizophrenia in areas which were like urban settings. So Chicago had a group who did a number of studies on that front. So it was the first basis of psychiatric immunology, often looking at group data and ecological type of associations. Then there is a second phase, which is like after World War II, developed slowly but surely in the 60s and 70s, this is where psychiatric diagnosis become more reliable, operationalized in diagnostic criteria and algorithm. The goal was not to be enamored with DSM, which I am not, but it was really to say, when you're going to see a doctor with a clinical presentation, if this doctor says he has disorder A, what is Dr. B saying? At the time, it was going all over the place. So the development of a diagnostic criteria was really an attempt to make diagnostic practice much more consistent across clinical centers and clinicians, and also for research. So we had this phase then where epidemiologists looked more at individuals affected with psychiatric disorders in population surveys. And you can see, for instance, in my field, child psychiatry, the pivotal study was the Isle of Wight studies in the UK in the mid-1960s. It really paved the way to the whole development of empirical research in child psychiatry. And there are other studies in the world. In adults, it was a bit later, with the ECA studies with Robbins in the 1980s in the US, and then National Comorbidities. There are many more studies. So it's not a review. So there have been a number of studies like that in multiple countries. Another point I want to make is, during this last 50 years, we have also seen in a number of countries the implementation of surveillance programs at the population level, which I want to mention that because I will return later to their usefulness for what we are trying to do. So that includes, for instance, there are regular surveys by the CDC when they were still a CDC. I hope they're going to continue, but they were doing surveys like, for instance, of youth adolescent risk behaviors. I've been a long series of that, allowing to look at trends and change over time. The same for the autism is actually now there are monitoring systems at the population level in the US. I will return to that. Again, I want to emphasize that this might be useful mechanisms for us to rely upon to test hypotheses about social factors. And then the risk factor research has really multiplied in all sorts of directions, so we'll touch upon that. So what have we learned from this last like 50 years? As people said, there is a huge amount of morbidity in the population due to psychiatric disorders. Here I start with developmental disorders. You can just, if you want to remember one number, is one child in six in the US between the age of 3 and 17 today, 2023, is affected by or has been affected in his development by a developmental disorder. That includes autism, ADHD, but also language disorders, motor delays, cognitive delays, intellectual disabilities, etc. So this group of what we call NDD, neurodevelopmental disorders, affects about one child in six. And this is quite robust, it's stable, has not really increased much in recent years. So that's a significant morbidity. And then this is just one of the slides, we discussed that many times, so I don't want to expand too much on that. The goal here is to look at the global, if you look at the bars on the left, they give you the rate of the any disorder in the population at the time of the survey, and you can see that these rates fluctuate anywhere, mostly between 35 and 25% in most countries, if you were to draw a line like this. And if you account for lifetime risk, the risk would be even higher because the more people age, of course, the more they develop some psychiatric conditions. So the morbidity due to mental health is enormous. We know that. We know that the age of onset is often during the child and adolescent years for many adult disorders, not always, but often it starts like in adolescence or even earlier than that. There is a co-occurrence of psychiatric disorders, so any individual who has a psychiatric disorder has a high likelihood, either contemporaneously at the same time or later, to develop other kinds of disorders. So depression goes hand to hand with anxiety. ADHD goes hand to hand with autism and language disorder. So there is a lot of comorbidity between conditions, which is not very fully understood. Access to treatment is limited. And then we know the large individual societal cost. Practically all conditions, when you look at them individually, are associated with this, an increase in mortality, like it's true for autism. Standardized mortality ratio are anywhere between 2 and 4. Anorexia nervosa is one of the most lethal psychiatric conditions. Many of them die by suicide. Schizophrenia too, so etc. So the mortality cost is quite substantial, and social inequalities, we've heard about that. So of the population surveillance program, I just wanted to illustrate what I said before. So this is just one of them. It's based on US data from the NCHS, where they run surveys every 2 years, I think, or every year, actually. It's a national survey, so it's well done in terms of sampling and representativeness of the population, and they track indicators. Well, here in this slide, you can see homicide rates, but suicide rates in particular. As you see in that slide, you see the rates of suicide in youth has increased over time, especially in females, and it's true in many other countries. It's true as well for non-suicidal self-injurious behaviors, like self-mutilation, which are quite frequent, quite increasing as well, and increasing even more in females today than in males. So monitoring these indicators is quite important because it gives, obviously, descriptive information on which some policymakers may want to act. But for researchers, it gives us a run of data over time that gives us opportunities to capitalize on events, on experiments, natural experiments which might occur and influence that rate. So that's the goal for me of emphasizing that aspect today. Like for autism, for instance, you see the rate was less than 1% in 2000. It's like 3.2%. This is the only monitoring system we have worldwide, except Australia. But that shows this steep increase, regular increase, that needs to be unpacked and understood because it's not actually a simple explanation. So in terms of risk factors, we have accrued a number of studies, but what I wanted to summarize here is in terms of the genetic risk factors, we have multiple replicated findings which show that, first, psychiatric disorders tend to cluster in families. That's an observation which has been made for centuries. And then when we calculate what is called the heritability, which is this quantity H square, this is really representing the proportion of the variance of the phenotype at the population level, which can be attributed to the effect of genetic factors. So it's not to say that X percent are due to genetic factors. It's more like it's a population level concept. But it shows nobody disputes this data. It shows that in all major psychiatric conditions, you have a contribution of genetic factors which is enormous or at least very high. Like for autism, it's about 90% now in recent data. The schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, ADHD, we are in the 60-70% range. Depression is still modest, 40%, but still 40%. So there are genetic contributors to the etiology of these conditions that cannot be ignored. So there are a lot of progress in finding genetic variants. It's very complicated, but now in terms of research, we have a way to actually measure genetic susceptibility, because we have now large genome-wide association studies which allow us to generate what we call these polygenic risk scores, which are, give you a sense of the genetic loading of an individual in terms of predicting that it's going to develop depression or autism or ADHD later. And we can incorporate that into our analysis, and it's being done increasingly. There are problems with polygenic risk scores, which I don't want to discuss. It's not the end of the story, but it's giving us a handle, an empirical handle, to measure genetic propensity or liability in a way that we didn't have 10 or 15 years ago. Apart from the genetic risk, the environmental risk, I'm not going to review that. So I think we have myriads of them which have been identified. And I find it very difficult to navigate that world. And I'll come back to that. It's one of my points. Certainly in terms of the social characteristics, we have studied individuals and children, in particular with individual disorders, and we know a lot of their individual characteristics, familial characteristics, even school characteristics that can be very influential in them developing or not a psychiatric disorder. So a lot of things known about proximal social risk factors and mechanisms. I think we have much less yet on those macro social factors, like policies or role, climate change, housing, all that stuff. It's more, there are newcomers in terms of risk factor research, but the way these macro social events impact mental health in the population and individual psychiatric disorders is probably mediated by some variable that are sometimes known, sometimes not, but there is a lot to do in terms of integrating different level of social contributions to the etiology of a disorder. Problem is that many, many exposures in our field come not in isolation. Like, for instance, there are a number of studies on pollution. When you say pollution, people look often at particulate matters or another thing or the NO2 or the they're going to pick up one substance, but pollution is usually a bunch of bad exposure, and when you are exposed to one thing, you are exposed to a multiplicity of things. And so the pollution example is one. So what does what is complicated because you need to adjust for the effect of co-exposure, and this is often not done, at least in this field, the part I know. And also co-exposure, like if you look at housing or poor housing, you're going to probably have also exposure to pollution at the same time. So how do you take into account these two factors? How do you extract the housing effect from this whole more broader environmental niche? And this is very complicated. The other thing I wanted to say is I think today I was very interested, but I heard relatively few studies referring to genetic factors. There was the impressive causal diagram loop by Naya, which was like showing all the multiple levels of analysis that we should incorporate, but actually very few studies incorporated data from the what you call the biological level in your slide. So I think this is important because genetic factors, as we just said, contribute to the liability to psychiatric disorders in a major way, but they also influence a lot of the lifestyle, behaviors of the parents, their selection of particular environments. So they might be also contributing to environmental factors, which might in turn increase the risk of the disorder. So I think including this level of analysis is key to the future. And then something which I think, despite a number of papers influential trying to look at resilience in the face of adversity, as you know, we have an odds ratio of 2 or 3 or 4 developing PTSD after a certain trauma, but that means that considering the base rate, many people who are exposed to this trauma do not develop a psychiatric disorder. So who are these people who are resilient to these social risk factors? And if we are concentrating on them probably a bit more, concentrating also about the recovery pattern of people who have disorders, we might also find association with environments which are much more protective of the subjects, encouraging resilience, or promoting recovery. And that would be a focus of interest in future studies that I would personally want to see developed. So the problem we face are, I think today, one of reproducibility. There are multiple risk factors which have been invoked or published in the literature. Many of them do not replicate. So when you see a study, and then there is another one, there is a failure of replication. And there are a number of issues here. You probably are very familiar with them. As I asked this morning in my question, I just wanted to point at the gap which exists in the literature between social epidemiology, where we talk about constructs which are broader than psychiatric disorders in the individuals. And I think each approach is absolutely valuable and necessary, but I think we need to try to understand at the individual level and also to look at the effect of social factor, how social factors, for instance, might facilitate the transition to a broader concept of misery, hopelessness, less into depression in these individuals, or not, or protect that. So it would be interesting to look at the two constructs simultaneously in the same data set that tend to be often separate. So something maybe to consider for the future. And then, my main goal today is like to also come back to the issue, these associations, these risk factors studies, of which we have a plethora for each conditions, how really can we ascertain that these associations are at even proxy measures of causal relationships between variables? What is causal and what is not? And I'm afraid that a lot of, in my domain, which is a bit special, I agree, a lot of things have been done recently to improve how we investigate epidemiologically causes of autism or other NDDs. And there are a number of techniques that I think you may know, but I will illustrate them now. I'm taking the example of autism because that's where I work. So this is a public-facing website by Autism Speak. So if you are a family and your child has been diagnosed with autism at age 3 or 4, and you look at that, and you see where does autism in my child come from? And then it comes from about everywhere. So you have studies which are associated with an increased risk of autism, which are basically associations, but not in no way studies which prove a causal connection between the two. And then in our professional literature, we have the same. So if you list, this is just looking at prenatal risk factors. It's just a small list. I could have probably done 2 or 3 slides like this. And you can, when you look at all these risk factors, so the first question is, what is the common pathophysiological mechanism that unites all these things? How come could they all be involved in the pathophysiology of this condition? It seems so heterogeneous and so disconnected that it calls into question certainly a causal interpretation of them. There are just of these, my assessment of the literature is that, you know, we have two of these risk factors have been solidly, robustly replicated and point at causal mechanisms. The rest is more like a series of association studies. Some are interpreted by some as causal, but many the causality has not been proven. And I'm going to show come back to this issue of what do we do in our studies. So we basically look at exposures and disorder. This is a mediating variable. And when we assess an association, we assess all that stuff. What we want to assess, in fact, is what is causal between E to D or EMD. These are the causality paths between E and D. But we want to get rid of this confounding kind of background, okay? And that's what we do when we do adjustments. We compute an association, and then we have the model, we adjust on confounders, and it has become much more complicated. And this is being done very, very well now in most studies. And the goal of that is to make the people who are exposed compared to the people who are not exposed more exchangeable at the beginning. Because we know if we don't adjust for that, the exposed and unexposed people will not be comparable, and therefore we will not be sure on how to interpret the relationship between E and D. So that's one step. The other step is this one, is that in each study there are, oh, I mean, you see that in the conclusions of, I love that, in the conclusion of the discussion, I do that too. Oh, this is, it might be residual confounding, you know. We use that magical phrase to say, well, there is probably confounding factors which are residual, which means that we couldn't measure them, we couldn't adjust on them. They might be operating and creating a spurious association. We don't know, but they are there. And they are there in each study. So I think it's important to understand that each, even single study, even well done, well powered, well analyzed in terms of the statistical data, will have, by definition, sources of bias which are not controlled, or other, also known as residual confounding or unmeasured confounders or unmeasured confounding. So that's the issue. So here, again, this is the first step. I said we can use a lot of this complex now, propensity scores, inverse probability of treatment weighting to make groups who are exposed and unexposed much more comparable and clarify the interpretation that we can produce of the data. But these techniques rely only on variables which are there to be adjusted for. So you can only adjust on what you have measured. And it could be measured well or not well. So if it's not measured well, your adjustment is going to be approximate. But any statistical techniques, even complex, does not address the question of unmeasured confounding, which, as I said, exists in our studies. So there are study design kind of approaches that can be employed, and I will illustrate some of them now because they have been clarifying in my field in recent years. So this is one question here is, you probably heard that in 2011 there was a study incriminating the taking of antidepressants by mothers during pregnancy, and that was increasing the risk of autism in their child at a later stage. That was an association study, okay, and there was a bunch of studies like this which were done, adjusting on various confounders. But then other studies started to be a bit more challenging this result and tried to look at, within their study, at designs that could really shed light on the presence or absence of unmeasured confounding. And here you can see that a common technique is to use what we call negative controls. And the story starts with, you look at mothers who are taking antidepressants during pregnancy have a 1.7 odds ratio of increasing the risk of autism in the offspring. So that's how it starts. Now, the question is, can you do an analysis in that same study that would debunk the interpretation that it's a causal effect of the medication on the fetus in the womb? Yeah, so, and yes, you can do it. You can do it in two ways. You can ask, was the mother taking medications before the pregnancy but stopped during pregnancy? And then, if the medication is really the culprit, the cause of the increase of autism in the first result, then by looking at mothers who took the antidepressants before but not during pregnancy, you should have no association with autism, because before pregnancy, taking antidepressants should not affect the development of the fetus. And here you can see in this analysis, in fact, even before pregnancy, you have still a very significant association, which means that this association, either here before pregnancy or there during pregnancy, is confounded by something which has nothing to do with a direct effect of the SSRIs on the fetus development. And then this is another way to do a negative control, is to look at the father. So they add this question, is the father taking an antidepressant during pregnancy, the same period? And then they found that, yes, you have almost a significant effect here. Again, that suggests that, because it's not possible that what the father is taking would lead to a negative outcome in the child, that points at confounding factors which are unmeasured in these studies, and therefore you can refute, in a way, the causal explanation that you would probably entertain with just these results. Now, this is the same here. You can the data for ADHD are even more impressive, so same story, basically. The other thing is that negative control is one thing. The second thing that you can do is try to control for unmeasured confounders by using family-based design. So, and the reason to do that is as follows. What we often do, we look at a risk factor of interest, like you can see maternal lifestyle, smoking during pregnancy, whatever it is, and the association with some outcome in the offspring. You're going to have a significant association. That's the way it starts. And then we do the adjustment and blah, 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 and then we conclude sometimes, or people tend to conclude, that there is a direct intrauterine effect. So this is like what we often see and read and do and communicate. The issue here is that there is a confounding path, which is here, this which is not controlled. To really assess causality in this relationship here, we need to block this causal pathway, which is operating. Okay, and the way to do it is, you lack the negative controls, you can do this control for this unmeasured confounders like genes and shared social influences in the family by simply comparing people living in the same family without necessarily measuring this. So you don't need to measure them. You don't need to increase the cost of data collection. It's just by creating this contrast that's gonna control for genetic effects and shared familial influences. And this is done by using often what we call sibling comparisons, and I will illustrate that in this next couple of slides. So here, this is another story. It's the same. It's another study, I guess. Antidepressants during pregnancy. You can see this is the adjusted hazard ratio, I think, or relative risk, 1.6. I don't see if it's significant. And then they did adjust on indications, so they restricted the analysis to mothers who had a history of depression, so that now they could reassess the link between taking an antidepressant and the outcome, and this became non-significant, although still a bit high due to maybe residual confounding, or we don't know. But then the definite analysis was this one, by comparing in the same data set, identifying mothers who have two siblings. They have one child, and child one and child number two, and then child during one of these pregnancies, she took an antidepressant, and she did not take an antidepressant in the other pregnancy. So you look at sibling pairs, and then which are discordant for the exposure. One has been exposed to a medication, the other was not exposed to a medication. And you compare the risk of the outcome within the pairs of discordant siblings. And that really control for the fact that they share 50% of their genes on average, and also that they have shared some time-invariant familial influences. So that's a very powerful strategy, which again does not necessitate to have measured this fact. It's an issue of design of the study and design of the analysis in a way that control for additional confounding factors, even if you don't know what they are controlled in this analysis. And that allows you to challenge or refute some interpretation that you would lean towards in the sort of main analysis. So that's a very powerful thing, and has been done this is, you probably heard recently because of the guy, the acetaminophen story, same thing. You see, in a big study, Swedish, I think, they have a significant effect of taking any dose of acetaminophen during the pregnancy in the whole database, like we talk about 2.5 million people. But when they did the sibling analysis, which was very well powered in the study, hundreds of thousands of sibling pairs discordant, then the risk disappears entirely. So the association is completely, fully attenuated in the sib-pair analysis, which really indicates that this estimate here is confounded by unmeasured genetic factors or social factors. Same thing, that was a replication study in Japan, which was important because replicating the same lack of association in the sibling analysis in a very different population, which likely differs for its structure of confounders, provides additional evidence for the non-causal interpretation. It's not only with biology and autism and things that are here. I find this study, like, this is a study on family income and psychiatric risk. And you can see here, it's in Finland, the large samples, population base, and they look at family income at age 15, and they follow since age 15 up to the onset of psychiatric disorder, up to age 13, I think, in their study. So a long follow-up study. And then they looked at, here, this is the dotted line is the null hypothesis, so it's like a value of one for an odds ratio or risk. And then this is the main first analysis, which is unadjusted, shows it's a protective effect. So the more the family income rises, the lower is the risk of 5 psychiatric outcome, substance use, anxiety, depression, etc. So, and then when they adjust, you see there is still some effect, which is like significant. But when they did the sibling analysis in that particular study, everything was attenuated and disappeared. So that's kind of an interesting result, which I think points at the possibility of residual confounding in those studies and at the usefulness of these approaches to test causality. And then the authors concluded that. I mean, we can dispute their conclusions or we can disagree. It's not my point. My point is the approach about finding an adjusted association which is significant and trying to find a way to deconfound this association even further than you usually do. Okay, that's the whole point of the sibling pairs analysis. And there are other techniques, by the way, that will not... Another thing that I mentioned is really capitalizing on natural experiments to test causal theories in our field. It's a kind of landmark studies in child psychiatry. There was a big study in the Great Smoky Mountain study. It's in North Carolina. Jane Costello and Adrian Engold were the PIs, and they were having waves of data collection in a population-based sample of children, 1,400, I think, and 300 or 400 of them were Indian American native kids. So they collected this data every year for 8 years, I think. And so they were in the process of doing that, and then in the middle of their study, there is a change of policy which has nothing to do with the study, where suddenly there is a casino which is open on the reservation where the Indian families, or some Indian families were made, and by law they receive royalties, they have preferential treatment to work there. So a lot of families really change their income level due to this opening of the casino, which was just magical for many of them. So they could, the principle here is that you have an event which is going to affect the people, but this event comes from the outside world. So people who are going to be exposed to that or not exposed, there is no difference in terms of their individual characteristic because the exposure is completely determined independently of individuals. So that makes a natural experiment something which is approaching quasi-randomization, as we often say. And then in that particular study, they could group the families into those who were never poor before, not poor before or after, persistently poor, and then ex-poor. So a number of families raised their income due to the casino. And you can see that here, they as a result of getting more income due to the casino, there was a decrease in symptom of psychiatric problems in their children. And then they started with the same level that they always poor, and they ended up in the same level than the never poor. So it's kind of a very telling story in terms of social causation in that particular example. It's a kind of an interesting example, a bit small in terms of sample, but we take what we have. Further outlining the probable causal connection between the two was the fact that the improvement of symptoms was not for all psychiatric symptoms, but mostly the externalizing symptom, oppositional tantrums, disciplining issues, all that stuff, but not for depression and anxiety symptoms. Which is interesting because, in fact, they also did mediation analysis in that particular study where they looked at the families who had get out of poverty. Was there any change in parenting in these families which might be a mediation between getting more income and then having a child with fewer symptoms? And in fact, they did that and found that parents were having more income as a result of this experiment of nature. Were becoming much better at supervising their children. I think also there was something about maternal warmth. So there were change in the family, in the individual, and the way parents were parenting, which also makes it a logical chain of events. Other kinds of things here, is another natural experiment which sometimes we find. There was an issue about mercury in some vaccines in childhood. I was in Canada then, and I was collecting data on children with autism. And in 1996, I think it's the Quebec authorities, they changed the fabrication of vaccines and combined 4 into 5 vaccines. They had to remove the mercury from the vaccines. So the mercury had been increasing in levels, like in childhood vaccine, and then suddenly it falls completely to zero. So you have like again an opportunity to look at an exposure which is varying, and then suddenly your exposure goes down to zero. There is no more individual exposed in the population, and this is again independent on the individual's concern. So it's kind of a policy decision. And here you can see that we model that in different ways. It's a relatively small study, but there was a trend before for increasing rates of autism, and then when this was down, there was no evidence of a lowering or an effect lowering the incidence of autism. So, what am I doing time-wise? Not good? Huh? I'm over time already? Oh my God. Okay. So I want to talk about that. So because I've seen triangulation today, I'll be brief. A number of times it was great, but we didn't. I think really triangulation is an approach in terms of thinking about we tackle causal questions using either one study or a series of studies and analytical approaches and design-based approaches. And I like to cite that. If you want to read this piece, like 3 pages, it's wonderful. And I borrowed their graph, which is basically saying that if you want to know this object, you measure it from this cliff with this whatever it is, and this instrument from this cliff or this person from this, you're going to have 3 different results, right? Okay, and each result will tell you some aspect about the facet of this object, but not of the other one. And then if you want to know the object, which is a metaphor I employ, you want to have the results of the 3 experiments, which are, what do they have is that they are different in terms of their source of bias or their limitations, of their angles, and that's why you can combine them and learn from them. And if you just do one approach, you're never going to get a knowledge of this beautiful tower. So, and then I want to say something about replication, and then I'll be done. Because this is like, we just love replication, you know? So, replication is necessary, but it's also overvalued in the sense that many replications, if they basically take the same type of approach, here they change something, the color of the gone, you know, so it's a green gone, so something has changed in the replication study, but fundamentally this study and these studies will be limited by the same bias. The perspective that they have is not long gonna, so you can do a replication, but if the replication doesn't address a deficiency or a limitation of the previous studies and add no value to then it's not a replication, it's just like repeating the same thing. Do we want that? No. And then this is what I think about meta-analysis often. I'm a bit facetious here, but this would be, for me, I see there is a factory to produce meta-analysis these days. And you see these papers where people like do the pile-up studies, like case control studies, and they have these meta-analytical estimates, which are often extremely precise and very, very impressive. But as I said, this is just a statistical technique. And if the meta-analysis have all the studies components, constituents of the meta-analysis have the same sources of bias and limitation, you can pile them up as much as you want. You're going to get a biased meta-analytical estimate. And everybody knows that, but we don't talk too much about it. This is my last one. So these are just things that I think we could encourage. In particular, I think the triangulation things is something that we can plan when we do a study. If you do a cohort studies, For instance, like a MOBA or ALSPAC or Millennium, why not sample in some families more than one child? For instance, you're going to have two children, so you're going to be able to do sibling comparisons later on. If you plan that, it might be very useful for you to do to control for genetic factors. So I think planning the triangulation in our interpretation of future results is what might advance us. Integrating genetic levels of analysis is important. You've seen the role of genetic factors in psychiatry before. So if we're going to look at environmental mechanisms, we need to take into account genetic factors as much as possible. It's not easy, but it's certainly an important level of analysis. And then, okay, and then the rest. I'm stopping because I'm done. I'm hot. I'm sorry.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.